Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, November 26, 2013, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Our special guest this evening is author Natalia Irena, and we'll be talking about her new book, Swan Mothers, Discovering Our True Selves by Parenting Uniquely Magnificent Children, sharing her story and the stories of other mothers whose children are changing the world by transforming their parents. Her own awakening began with the birth of her children, helping her transcend the third-dimensional life she had been living. And her websites are Swan Mothers, that's S-W-A-N, swanmothers.com, and NataliaIrena.com, and that is spelled N-A-T-A-L-I-A-E-R-E-H-N-A-H.com. And we'll be going over that one again. Okay, at the top of the show, we'll have the Starseed News segment with Anastasia, bringing topics of interest to Starseeds. And we'd like to thank Chris and Fiona for hosting our switchboard this evening. And you're welcome to call in with questions or comments. And the number to dial is 917-889-8292. And do remember to press 1 on your keyboard so we know you want to come on the air. And if you do like our show, we'd appreciate your support by clicking follow on our show page. Well, our main site, starseedhotline.com, has been coded for Starseed activation, and it holds a wealth of Starseed information in our vault. Make sure you check that out if you haven't yet. We also have a forum for Starseeds at starseedhotline.ning.com. And we'd like to thank Rose and Tammy for their great work and dedication on behalf of our Starseed forum. You can find us on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go, or you can download them right from our show page archives. If you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our site is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. And if you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by getting your solar return timing. And please allow at least 2 weeks ahead of time to make sure that you do get it in time. And if you'd like a Stage 2 reading to interpret those solar return energies beyond just knowing when it's happening, please make sure you book that about 2 months ahead because we do have a waiting list. So now I would like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Hello, Anastasia and Lavendar. How are you this evening?
Good evening, ladies.
Hey,
well,
hey Lavendar.
Here. So, Anastasia, I'm really anxious to hear what you have to tell us tonight. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with everybody. The weeks fly by. And
you.
I'm happy to be here on tonight's show. It's going to be a great show. Well, in tonight's news, I want to talk a little bit about space before we get into some of our more terrestrial subjects. I'm sure you've all heard about Comet Ison getting closer and closer. And they say that Comet Ison is going to sweep through the sun's atmosphere on November 28th. That just happens to be day after tomorrow. And they say it will be in the hot zone for CMEs, or coronal mass ejections. Now, a strike by one of these massive storm clouds on the sun probably won't destroy Comet Ison, but they say it will have a dramatic effect on the comet's tail. And they say the odds of a strike depend on which side of the sun is facing the comet during the time of the flyby, and they do suspect that it probably will strike the sun, at least a glancing blow. So all eyes are on the sky and on Comet Ison among the astronomers out there looking. And there have been a number of fireballs yesterday. There were 9 sporadic fireballs, which are not attributed to any major meteor shower, 1 Leonid and 1 November Orionid, but there has been a lot of fireball activity as always. And there is a near-Earth asteroid coming our way, or a near-Earth object, I should say, that is going to be here actually, let's see, today. I don't know what time, but it's called 2013NJ, and it's going to pass only 2.5 lunar distance between here and the moon sometime today. It may have already flown by now. And they have discovered yet another comet. Comets everywhere, people. I'm telling you, there are comets all over the place. I have lived a long time, and I never remember so much talk about comets in the sky.
Really?
Yes, it's amazing. And now they have found another near-Earth object. I mean, I don't know what they're doing. Are they out there using Windex on these mirrors or something? Because they are picking up stuff right and left that before it was like the lights were out. Nobody could spot these things. So they've got some pretty amazing technology now, because every day practically you hear about new discoveries about incomings or near-Earth objects or comets, things they're finding that just was not available to hear about before. But anyway, this near-Earth object is 2013 US 10. It's called Catalina, and it is another comet coming into the solar system. I think there's four. Don't quote me on this, people, and I'm sorry I'm not better prepared. I told myself I was going to get that figure together, but I'm speaking from memory at this point. I think there's four in the sky right now. This one, I think, makes four. And so, anywho, that's an amazing thing. And in your neck of the woods, Lavendar, they say that there was a meteor fireball that went over Oklahoma and Texas that was so bright that the residents of Grayson County reported that a plane had crashed into Lake Texicoma. And after they investigated, the authorities didn't find an airplane. They found evidence of a crash site that they thought was a meteor that fell from the sky. So still, we have lots of that going on up there. And there has been also something that's occurred near the constellation Leo that has astronomers abuzz. They say that it's the brightest explosion in the universe ever seen, and it is defying astronomical theory. They say that a mysterious body in the constellation Leo was actually the brightest gamma-ray burst ever recorded. And they say it was triggered by an extremely powerful stellar explosion. Now, you know, gamma-ray bursts are the most powerful type of explosions in the universe, and they typically mark the destruction of a massive star. So that's going on out there. We are really getting some major visuals here from these telescopes.
Well, I have to ask, though, if it's that far away, that blast could have happened a long time ago, and we're just now finding out about it.
Well, absolutely, Ariel. Now, you know, the person that wrote this article, it's space.com, did not point that out, or maybe I didn't note that.
Well,
but you're absolutely right. No telling when.
But, you know, depending on how many light years it is away, it could happen
exactly.
To 100 years ago.
Well, it's a long ways away. It's a long ways away. But, yeah, that's right. That's absolutely true. But it would be a fun time to be an astronomer if you were into that sort of thing. What
sure,
a time.
With the technology, the way, you know, you said, the technology is getting better and better, so we have more access.
Absolutely. You know, we talk about, what was it, 20, 30 years ago, everybody wanted to be a lawyer and a doctor because there was a shortage. Well, now we have an overabundance of those professions, but with science moving forward like it is, technology, this would be a great time to get into astronomy, you young people, because I really do suspect that the data that they're pulling in is going to be much more than the average astronomers are going to be able to keep up with. It's probably a pretty good field to get into right now. Don't quote me on that, but I would imagine it would be. Anyway, we need to ask ourselves a question, folks, and that is that why have 10 major volcanoes along the Ring of Fire suddenly just roared to life? Now, during the past few months, I've been kind of alluding to this and keeping an eye on it, but during the past few months, 10 major volcanoes have erupted along the Ring of Fire. And, of course, you know, the mainstream media has been pretty quiet about this, but this is really a big deal. You know, we're seeing eruptions at some volcanoes that have been dormant for decades. And, it's not unusual for two or three major volcanoes along the Ring of Fire to be active at the same time, but witnessing 10 of them is really highly unusual. And for those of you that don't know, the Ring of Fire is an area where there is a large number of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions in the basin of the Pacific Ocean. They say it's about a 25,000-mile horseshoe shape, and it's associated with a nearly continuous series of oceanic trenches, arcs, volcanoes, belts, plate movements, stuff like that. They say it has 452 volcanoes and is home to over 75% of the world's active and dormant volcanoes. So Ring of Fire is probably a pretty good name for that area.
Yeah.
But among these volcanoes, there was one off the coast of Japan. A dramatic volcanic eruption in the Pacific Ocean created a brand new island on Japan's territorial waters, and they say that's the first time in decades. In fact, some reports say it's never happened before. This particular report said that it was the first time in decades that Japan had ever seen anything like this. And it was spotted just off the coast of Tokyo on Wednesday, and they say that they had video footage of it with plumes of smoke and ash billowing up from the little island that came up from the ocean. So they were warning vessels to stay away from that little island and that area until the eruption cools off. Also, Mount Sinabung in Indonesia is really going off. It's blowing its stack. It's raining down rocks over a large area and just forcing out thousands and thousands of people. Now, it's been erupting on and off since September, but they say it went into overdrive late Saturday and early Sunday, and now it's spewing out red-hot ash and rocks up to 5 miles into the air. We also have the Columa volcano in Mexico. That just happened a couple of days ago. They say it ejected lava and ash skyward. It covered some villages. And so they say that that has got people really concerned and evacuating as well. There's another volcano in Japan, apart from the one that I just mentioned, the undersea volcano that created the island. This one is Sakajirima, and they say that it has begun to erupt more violently. It's had explosions and has sent ash plumes up to 15,000 feet, and they say that the ash emissions have been just about constant since that started. There is the volcano Fuego in Guatemala. Excuse me. Try to say that, Ariel. Fuego in Guatemala. That's pretty hard to say. Anyway, they say, you want to try it? Fuego in Guatemala. Can you do that?
Fuego in Guatemala?
That's really
Central America.
Good. That's it. I'm satisfied now. Thank you.
Okay.
Anyway, two lava flows are active on the upper slopes of that volcano right now, and they say that that started on the 11th of November. It increased on the 18th of November, and they say there are constant avalanches from the flows, and they say that there is explosive activity at the crater with low to moderate levels, and they do say that there are Strombolian explosions. Now, those are big, and they produce ash plumes up to 800 meters in height, and they create incandescent jets that you can see from a distance. So that's pretty huff and puff and all kinds of stuff.
Wow.
In Guatemala, we have the Santa Maria volcano, and that is a water magma interaction-driven explosion. And that just happened a couple days ago. And that put up a plume of ash. And then we have the volcano Yasser in Vanuatu. No, I'm not done yet. I'm still going here. This volcano produces near-continuous ash emissions. They say the explosions on this one, however, are relatively weak. But they think that this is going to go on all the rest of the month. It started around the 1st of November, so that if it does continue through the end of the month, this is 30 days of constant ash belching going on. And the Popocatépetl in Mexico, that volcano showcased, they say, a layer of snow was melted or came down from this exhalations of that volcano. It melted some snow. And they say that it has produced 57 exhalations of low intensity, but they are keeping an eye on it because that is action, and action means wide eyes. Mount Merapi in Indonesia is also erupting. It is shooting black ash about 2,000 meters up. And a volcano in Russia had a really busy weekend after a busy week. And they say a lot of the action was caught on webcams. And they say that the volcano has produced vigorous lava fountains and lava flows mixed along with Strombolian explosions. They'd say that sent bombs down the slopes of a volcano, huge rolling rocks of boiling lava coming down the side of that volcano, and this has caused aviation alerts over the western Aleutian Islands. So there we have it. That's a lot of volcanic activity across the planet, and, you know, environmentalists, scientists are concerned about global cooling. We hear a lot about global warming, but there is a opposing faction that thinks we may be at risk for an ice age, and they have their eyes on this ash in the sky because that does contribute to the cooling of temperatures. In fact, one of these volcanoes in question, which I can't tell you offhand because I can't remember, they say has cooled the temperature, global temperature, 0.5 already, just from one of them. So they're already noting a cooling trend, and we're going into winter in the northern hemisphere, so who knows what kind of cold swings we're going to have this year. But that does contribute volcanic activity. And also I want to share something with you. This is really interesting. You know, years and years and years, years ago, there was talk from clairvoyants and gifted people about pole shift. I mean, this was way before everybody out there was so well informed and star seeds were identified and pulling together and into a stronger community of consciousness. Before the consciousness movement actually took effect, there was talk of polar shifts and magnetic shifts and so on, and it seemed like real science fiction, but no more. In fact, it is reality that the Earth's magnetic field is undergoing some weird things, and as evidence of that, Europe next week will launch a trio of high-tech satellites to explore the Earth's magnetic field. Now, they say that they're looking for the reasons why the planet's magnetism is acting very weird. They say that the magnetic pole is changing and the magnetic field is too, and they want to know why. They say that the well-known gap between Earth's magnetic north pole and its geographic north pole, the magnetic north pole versus the geographical north pole, is growing. They also say that since 2001, this gap has been widening at the rate of 40, almost 41 miles per year, compared with just 6 miles per year in the early 1990s. That's quite a big jump.
Yeah, it is.
And they say that along with that, the magnetic field has been weakening, and that since the mid-1800s, the magnetic field of our planet has lost around 15% of its strength. Now, you know, these experts are wondering if this is a prelude to something really big, as in a reversal of magnetic polarity. And they say that this has occurred, does occur, and will occur around every 200,000 to 300,000 years, according to the magnetic signatures found in ancient sediments. Now, they are believed to occur when iron atoms in lava spewed by volcanoes adopt a polarity and retain it after the rock has solidified. Eventually, they say, a planetary tipping point is reached. Now, they say and assure us that reversals are a slow process, and they don't happen with any predictable regularity, but they say that the last time this happened was about 780,000 years ago, and they think that now we are overdue for a magnetic reversal. So that's all very interesting stuff. And there's been, I'm going to just tell you this and then we're going to end the news, but you know, there's been talk about the discovery that dinosaurs never stopped growing, that they continued to grow until they died, meaning that if they had never died, they would have continued to get larger and larger and larger. Now, that's some new scientific studies and findings that are suggesting that. Well, now there is a study of amber, fossil amber, that says that Earth's ancient atmosphere had relatively low oxygen content. The prevailing theories up until this point has been that it was a high oxygen content in the atmosphere that made all the animals grow so large. But the new study suggests it's just the opposite. They say that low oxygen made the animals grow large. And what they have discovered, they went through and they studied, I don't know, 500 and some samples of amber, the resin from trees. And by analyzing this fossilized resin, they found that atmospheric oxygen over the past 220 million years averaged considerably lower than today's 21%. They say that in the dinosaurs' days, the oxygen was between 10 and 15%. So when the oxygen dropped, the animals grew. And so, anywho, that's all very interesting stuff.
Yeah,
isn't that fun?
Yeah.
Would have been fun to be, you know, in go dig dinosaur bones and do stuff like that. But anyway, that's tonight's news, and I'm really looking forward to the show.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Anastasia, for the Starseed news. And I am going to turn it over to Lavendar at this time, and I'm going to bring Natalia on as soon as the switchboard is suddenly filled up. So where'd you go? Okay. All right. Okay. Hello, Natalia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I am honored to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you, and Lavendar is going to kick it off for us. And Lavendar, are you there?
Yes, I am. Okay,
okay.
Natalia, welcome. I'm so
Thank
glad
you.
To have you on the show so that you can share your stories about what you've come to know as being a swan mother. So why don't you first tell us a little bit about yourself, about how you came to write this wonderful book.
Well, the thing that always stands out for me as I think about this journey is that the first 30 years of my life, almost, were very ordinary and in the best way possible. I just had, like, such a nice upbringing and a nice, happy family, and certainly not perfect. It's not like, you know, we were living in some sort of TV show or something, but everything was really nice and really calm, and everything in my life was just going the way that I thought it was supposed to, the way I had expected it to. And then when my children arrived, they ended up being very, very different than what I expected. And I think I'll probably talk about that a little bit more later. But it started with, really, by the time my daughter was 3 days old, I had brought her home from the hospital where she was born. And the first couple of days, everything was fine. And the third day, she started crying and wouldn't stop. And I thought, uh-oh. But and everything started changing, and more dramatically when shortly before her third birthday, her preschool teacher came to me and mentioned that she thought that my daughter was autistic. And that just completely turned my world upside down. But I'll get to that story later. But as to how I got to write the book, so this word autism came into my life, and I had always known that I was a good writer, but I was busy doing other things because I thought that it was, you know, would be too lazy of me to do something that came easily for me, which sounds like such a ridiculous thing to say, but that was my thinking. So I studied other things in school, did other things for my job, and then finally, as I got to know myself from having my children, I began to study the natural health sciences, and I decided to open an online, but or rather by phone kind of healing business, doing homeopathy and meridian tapping, which I had been studying. And as part of opening a business, which I knew nothing about, I was listening to how to run a business, telesummits, things like that. And on one of them, there was a speaker that said, write a book to establish credibility. And as much as the idea that I could write a book to establish credibility didn't appeal to me, it was like this big light bulb went off over my head, and I thought, right, yes, I should write a book. I should write a book about everything I've learned from parenting my children. And so I set out to write the book, and it was a rather roundabout process to come to the book that I wrote, because when I thought to write the book, first I thought, well, I'll write all about how homeopathy and meridian tapping are wonderful. And then I thought, oh, I'll write about everything I've learned from autistic people about, you know, how they would like to be viewed, the autistic adults whose words I've been reading. And I started interviewing mothers, and I started interviewing autistic adults, and it was sort of all over the place, as I suppose a lot of projects are at the beginning. And then I was attending a write shop with the woman who ended up being my writing coach, but it was the first time or second time I was sitting in her house at a group she had, and she started talking about how writing a book is like taking a hero's journey. And I had never heard these words, even though I'm sure many of your listeners have. And as she described what a hero's journey is, I just started scribbling and writing, and before she was done with her half-hour or hour presentation, I had the whole outline of my book, because I realized that my story and the story of many of the mothers that I've been talking to followed this exact pattern, this archetypal pattern of the hero's journey. And that's how it ended up being Swan Mothers, even though the name came much later, but the structure came at that point.
Wow. Okay, so how many children do you have?
I have three children. They are now 15, 13, and my youngest just turned 11. And my daughter, who started this whole thing for me, actually never ended up getting an autism diagnosis, but my second child, a boy, is diagnosed with autism.
So I
do like to say, though, that they are – none of them are typical. There's a word in the autism community for people who are not autistic, they call the other people neurotypical. And I sort of suspect that nobody's really that typical, but definitely my children aren't, and I don't think I am, and – I suspect that most people listening to this show probably wouldn't fall under the typical category either, or neurotypical.
Well, so maybe your children are starseed children.
You know, they could be, and I don't know. You know, I've read that page so many times on your website, and I'm not sure. I think, and maybe because I got kind of jaded by the labels, starting with the one that was allegedly a bad label, you know, autism. And I've since discovered that autistic people are actually very proud to be autistic and are happy to be autistic and don't want to be neurotypical. But because I got jaded with the labels, the word indigo children were something that came up early on, and it was something that was a lifesaver for me. But then as things evolved, I was like, I'm not sure. Maybe we don't need that either. So I don't know, but they could be starseeds. I don't know.
Well, I'm finding through my experience in doing charts, I find that a lot of children that say they're autistic aren't really autistic. They just have a different way of processing information that has to do with the evolution of the planet, and they're tuned into a whole different drummer that has a whole different agenda. That's what I've been finding.
I think that's true, and I suspect there's not even one other drummer. I think there are so many different kinds of children and adults also that I suspect there are many drummers, and we're just tuning into a lot of energies that are around now, and we're not all seeing the same thing, sort of what, you know, we used to see and consider normal.
How long did it take you to write this book?
It took me about a year to do the majority of the writing, and then about another year to decide to self-publish. So, about a year to write it.
Okay.
Once it got going.
What has been the feedback that you've gotten from people that have autistic children?
The feedback I'm getting from people that are reading it has been extremely positive and very gratifying. And if anybody who's listening is interested in what it is, I do have it on my own website, plus also you can just pick it up from Amazon.com. So, but the people that are reading it are just saying incredibly wonderful things like, "If I wish I would have known this when my kids were younger," or, you know, a lot of people told me, I've had people email me or contact me through social media when they start reading the book, and they'll tell me, "I'm on page 3 and I'm crying already." And I think they're crying because there's something there that speaks to them. There's something that tells them that they're being seen and recognized, something about themselves, you know, that maybe they haven't had anybody else reflect for them before.
So do you think that there should be a school put together for autistic kids, or do you think the autistic kids should blend in with the other children? What's your feeling about the educational process of autistic children?
I think that every one of them is different, and that there is no one simple answer to your question. I suspect that some of the children would do extremely well in a specialized school, but the children that are called autistic, there is such a tremendous spectrum, and the spectrum is not like of one thing. So, you know, there are different, they have different abilities to sit in a classroom with, you know, lights, like fluorescent lights bother them, some of them. You know, some of them can handle noise, some can't. Some of them can read well, some can't. Some can understand language, some can't. So I think that it has to be looked at individually, but I do think that that's actually one of the things that's going to happen with our children in the schools, is that the schools are getting shaken up because more and more children are being diagnosed with autism and are showing up in our schools. So the schools have to look at these kids and they see that there is really no one-size-fits-all solution. And I think that's actually pretty exciting. I don't know what's going to happen with that and how it will look, but I think they're actually going to change the system that we have in place, whether that comes about because there are specialized schools or because they change the schools that they're already in, like the traditional public schools. Or a lot of people homeschool children who are autistic now because schools can't meet their needs. So I think there are just lots and lots of exciting possibilities, and I think they're just shattering so many paradigms, so many things that we took for granted.
So do you know of any online courses that people can take at home for autistic talent? I mean, that should be, you know, something that the Internet should have jumped all over, is putting together, you know, classes for people that have to stay home and train their children. That'd be really something.
You know, it would be, but I think the problem is, like I said, that they're not all the same. You know, so I think that that's the fundamental problem. Like, I have homeschooled all of my children off and on. My two older ones are currently in public school, but I think that the problem with coming up with a program is that even with my own children, what worked for one does not work for the next. And it's really hard to picture a program that would work for everybody.
Yeah. Can you tell us some stories about some things that you've experienced maybe with your child or someone else's child, or a story that would interest our viewers?
Talk less about the children than about my own personal journey as a mother, and that was one of my choices in writing the book. It's a very touchy subject, you know, when you have children who are out there and can hear you on the radio or read what you write. And, of course, I wrote a book, so I'm particularly sensitive to this and, you know, never quite sure, you know, where to draw that line. But I think the thing is that for me with my children, I really haven't had the magical experiences, and that's one of the things that for me stands out. There are other people who have written rather more magical or maybe more starseed-type books about the children. There's a woman named Susie Miller. I think her book is called Awesomism, and there's another woman called Gail Barkley Lee, and she wrote a book with her daughter, who is an adult, who is a non-speaking adult, but she does write, and their book is called Autism, but it's spelled AWETIZM. And those books speak more, perhaps, about the experiences you're referring to, like the ability to communicate telepathically or, you know, connect with other dimensions. With my own children, I haven't experienced that, and I think that's one of the parts that I like to tell, is that even without those abilities, the things that seem to make them special, or the kind of things that make, you know, good radio or good videos that go around, they're still changing us because they still opened me up to a whole new world, even without any of that, I don't know what to call it, you know, those kind of more exciting things.
Okay, so what are some of the tools that have helped you change?
Well, what's helped me the most has been homeopathy. I discovered sort of homeopathy just from the way lots of mothers do, having teething children, and when they were teething, you know, I kind of found those remedies, and then I started studying it more and more, and homeopathy has just been a miracle in my family. And what I'd like to say is that a lot of people in the autistic community are very opposed to the idea of a cure at all, because they do not want to be cured. So that's something I've learned from autistic adults. So what I'd what is different to me about homeopathy is that I believe that homeopathy brings out the best of a person, and it certainly helps alleviate physical difficulties, but at the same time, I think that it really brings out our truest selves. So I've used homeopathy a lot, and I also use something called matrix re-imprinting, which is subset of EFT, or the emotional freedom techniques, which are the kind of meridian tapping thing where you can go back and look at past events in your own life and change how they affect you. So those are the tools that I use the most. And I use them the most actually for myself, because I find that the more I change, the more I can be a better parent to my children and help them to be themselves, because the more I'm willing to be myself, the more I'm willing to expect them being themselves instead of being the kind of kids that I was expecting them to be.
Yeah, I get that. So you have written this book, and what is the name of the book again, and give us the website.
The name of the book is Swan Mothers, Discovering Our True Selves by Parenting Uniquely Magnificent Children, and the website is swanmothers.com.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the transformation of you and how that you, you've told us a little bit about the tools that have helped you change. Have you had anything else besides homeopathics? Have you done any acupuncture or herbs or essential oils or anything like that?
I've tried all of those things, but the ones that helped me the most were those two. But I would say the most important thing that's been a tool is my willingness to change. And maybe this would be a good time maybe even to talk about how the hero's journey was how I changed. Because what happened was that as I was going along in the ordinary world, so to speak, just living, like I said, an ordinary life is – I just wasn't aware that there was anything else out there. You know, I wouldn't, besides the things like homeopathy and meridian tapping, I certainly didn't have any awareness of star seeds or indigo children, or just even the possibility that the world was, you know, as old as it is, or just anything like that. So I was just living my ordinary life, and I was kind of expecting that my children would follow in my footsteps, so to speak, and that they would just live a better version of the life I'd lived. You know, I thought, I'll kind of tweak a couple of things that maybe, you know, I thought could be done better, and, you know, and everybody will live happily ever after. And what happened was when my daughter's preschool teacher came up to me and said, you know, we think your daughter is autistic, my whole world just came crashing down around me. I mean, I honestly had, I don't know if I had even ever heard the word autism. And it was 12 years ago. And it's hard to imagine that such a short time ago, there was so little information available, both about autism, but also even as far as the internet, it was so new. I mean, it just seems like everything has changed so fast. But I did manage to find out some things about autism just by looking things up. And I was just shocked. I mean, because everything was presented as just so terrible. The future just seemed so bleak. The only model of autism I could find was one of a disease. You know, so here I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do? And so what happens on the hero's journey, maybe I could just relate that, is that that's called the call to adventure. When everything that's going along normally in your world, suddenly everything gets shaken up. And suddenly you have to change. Well, you don't have to. I guess you can always say no. And that's something that happens next on the hero's journey, is that you can say no. And that's actually exactly what I did. And it was fairly common experience amongst the mothers I interviewed. You know, somebody says your child has autism, or, you know, you have to do something differently, and you say no. So, you know, I thought about it, I looked it up, and then I decided, nope, the teacher is wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. My child is not autistic. There's nothing wrong with her. And at that point, a lot of mothers go through the classic stages of grief, like denial and anger and being really scared and grieving. And the thing you grieve for, it's, you're not grieving for the child you have. I don't think that there's ever a time when you know, I mean, I know there's never a time when I didn't love my children, but you grieve, like, this dream that you had that your children were going to be these perfect little mini-me's, and this life that you thought you were going to have doing these things with these, you know, so-called normal children. But then as things went along, I realized that, you know, nope, there was something to it. I mean, I wasn't sure what it was. I wasn't sure if it was autism, but I realized that there was something that had to be done. And that's the point in the hero's journey where we cross the first threshold. And, you know, we embark on something new in our life. You know, and for some people, that can happen through all kinds of things. Some people are called to adventure, you know, through disease or accidents or, you know, I don't know, divorce. Like, so many things can call people to adventure and take them out of the life that they thought they were going to have. And for me, you know, it was this idea that my child, that something was wrong with my child. And at that time, I really thought something was wrong with her. And once I kind of accepted that this disease model, that something was wrong with her, you know, I set out to fix her. And on the hero's journey, that's known as the road of trials. And boy, you know, when those of us who were living like this classic type A lifestyle, when we set out on it, we really go. You know, I was doing all kinds of research, reading all kinds of books, taking her to all kinds of therapists, and my goal was to fix my child. And the problem is that nothing was working. And so there I was trying to make her something that she was not, you know, not seeing who she was, because the only model I had for who she was supposed to be is what I had thought she was. And so somewhere along the way on the hero's journey, we go into the abyss. And for me, that came on a day when she was in first grade, 7 years old, and in her fifth school in 5 years. So we had done all the schools that are supposed to be so good for, you know, our kids. We had been in a Montessori, we'd been in an experimental school, and we were finally in the Waldorf school, and everything was supposed to be perfect. And we had really, really gone out of our own comfort zone to even try this school. And not even halfway through the year, the teacher called us in and said, you know, we're going to have to ask you to leave. And I went home, and I thought my whole world fell apart. You know, I just had no idea what to do at that time. And somewhere along the way in that night, when I woke up in the morning, I just knew I was going to homeschool my daughter. And even though now to me that sounds like the most natural thing in the world, at that time it was something that I had never, ever considered. I mean, didn't know anybody who homeschooled children. It was just not a model I had followed. I mean, I had gone to school. Everybody else I had known had gone to school. And for me, that's where the change came. And after that, everything started getting better because I finally realized that there was nothing to be fixed about my kids. You know, that my daughter was perfect the way she was. My sons were perfect the way they were. There was nothing to fix. And as I finally accepted that about them, then I finally accepted that about myself. And it was just, that was a transformation. And as I was able to embrace them exactly as they are, I was able to embrace myself. And then I started looking not only at myself and my children, but at everybody in the world and saying, hey, you know, everything doesn't have to be the way I thought was correct. You know, there are many ways to be correct. And I think that when that change comes, that's when we begin to change the world, because suddenly you realize that the old way is not the only way and that, you know, that the change is coming. So,
you know, as we come into this world, we are influenced by our teachers, our, you know, our parents, our people around us, television, movies, books, and somewhere along the way we get into programs of other people and thinking this is the way we should be because others are like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we have autistic children show up or starseeds or people that are so different from the norm, you know, it throws a lot of people a lot of curves because they want to go more toward being normal or they like to compare themselves with others.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't compare some of these, you know, indigos, crystal children, autistic children, whatever you want to call them. You can't compare them with anyone or anything else because I really feel like they have been brought to this planet to do things that maybe we don't even know about what they do at night when they sleep or when they step out of body. There's no telling what is happening with a lot of these autistic children. I know the indigos and the crystal children that I have dealt with and seen, they really give me great hope for what's happening for our future on this planet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
So it sounds like you have just really grown by leaps and bounds through these experiences that you've had. It's transformed you. That's why you call yourself a transformed mother, right?
Yes. Yes, and I'd like to say also that my experience isn't unique. That's the one thing that I discovered as I was talking to other mothers, that I discovered that this kind of journey that I describe is actually fairly common. You know, I mean, like, you know, I'm special, but so are so many other women. You know, there are so many of us that are discovering that, and I think that as we discover that our children are, shall I say, have a more expanded awareness than we thought even existed, we realize that we have it too. We realize that all of us aren't as small as we had thought that we were. You know, and I think that's where the change comes, when the whole world starts embracing the possibility, like you said, that, you know, you talk to them and we don't even know what's coming.
So are you married? Do you have a husband that goes on this journey with you?
I do. I do.
How has this affected him?
Well, he's definitely been on this journey every step of the way with me. He always says that I'm the one that is leading the way, but I really think that what we have is a really true partnership, and there are things that he does that make our journey possible, and there are things that I do. And I certainly have been the one that does the reading and finds the radio shows and finds the books and, you know, finds the new words and the new experiences. But it's because he does what he does that I am even able to do that. And, you know, he can see all the changes that are coming too.
Well, that's great that you have someone that's really... That helps you a great deal to know that you've got a partner that's in this with you. That's wonderful.
I do, and you know, I do feel very lucky. And I'm also I have read many times they have a statistic that, and now I don't remember the statistic, so I won't even say it. But they claim that a very high percentage of parents of autistic children are divorced, like way higher than the average rate. And at least with the people who I spoke to, not everybody, not all of the mothers were happily married. Some were divorced, some were single for other reasons. But I certainly was not unique in having a supportive partner. There were many mothers who had supportive partners that were, you know, like you said, along for the ride, or however we want to phrase it. You know, that were, you know, kind of the whole family was in it together.
So, do you have a support group where you live now? Are there other mothers that you meet with regularly and discuss things?
I do not. I do have friends, but not a support group for the kind of mother. Not for this kind of thing. I don't know how to phrase that. I do know other mothers of autistic children. I do have one friend who I spoke to, interviewed with when I was writing the book. This is actually a kind of a funny story. Is that I was not living where I'm living now when I was writing this book. I was living in Wisconsin, and I had requested at a mother's forum online that people to speak to. And the very first person I spoke to when I moved to my new home, in my son's class, there was another autistic boy, and I met his mother, and we exchanged emails. And when I was emailing her, I realized that I had her email in my folder. And she was the first person I had spoken to when I was writing the book, which was funny. It's one of those small world stories. But as far as finding groups, actually, I think that the Internet is such a wonderful thing for that, because the people that we can't necessarily find, you know, in our immediate communities to form a group, you know, we can find those people online, people that have, especially when are looking for somebody with ideas that most people would consider kind of out there. You know, it's harder to find those people locally, but online it is easier to find those kind of groups.
So does your daughter have any artistic talent? Does she draw or paint or What's her specialty? What does she like?
Her specialty. She actually drew the cover of the book, so she does have artistic talent. And now, of course, you know, because the cover was drawn a year and a half ago, you know how quickly kids change. So now she keeps saying, "Oh, I could do so much better," and things like that. But she does. My daughter does draw, and my boys. Let's see. Do they have special talents? Actually, I nothing really stands out, and I said that's one of the things that is interesting to me, that when I read a lot of the articles, sometimes I felt really left out. Like, well, my children don't have, like, these, really exciting skills, like, like I said, the ones, like, the YouTube videos that go around. But I still think that they're very special, and I think just because I can't see them, you know, solving complex math problems or going to college when they're 13 or things like that, it doesn't mean that they're any less important to the planet.
Of course not.
Right. No, I know. It's just a lot of times when we see the stories on the news, of course we see things that are interesting because, well, that's why they're on the news.
I think the first time I really got introduced to autism was when the movie Rain Man came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never really thought about it until that movie, and that movie just, it really moved me quite a bit to see what he went through in his journey.
I've never seen it.
Enjoyed talking to you, but I'm going to turn it over to Ariel now, and she has the switchboard, and there may be people that want to call and talk to you or ask you questions. So it's been my pleasure talking to you, Natalia, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Ariel, back to you.
Okay, well, we do have callers on the switchboard, and if anyone has a question or comment, you need to press 1 on your keypad so we know you want to come on the air. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for that, Natalia, how did you come up with the title? Swan Mothers.
I was at a retreat for speakers, and I had the book pretty much finished, but I did not have a title. And we were talking about I was using the story of the ugly duckling to illustrate the hero's journey, the steps of the hero's journey. And at some point during that seminar, it was a seminar where we were spending a lot of time in reflection and mirroring things back and forth to each other. And suddenly, I was talking about the story of the ugly duckling, and somebody said something about the swan, and the name just came to me. And as soon as it did, it seemed like such an obvious name, but I had been struggling to find a name for a long time. So.
Well, it's very descriptive, and it really gets the point across. And let me ask you, so your oldest daughter,
mm-hmm.
it turned out that she doesn't have that the autism label?
No, she does not have the label. She's very quirky and interesting, but the people who were doing the evaluations never could quite pin a label on her, which I think is very telling just in general. It's really hard to describe people with any, you know, label. And,
right,
and
yeah.
Labels can be so comforting. It can really help you to find a home and to find your tribe and to find people who are like you. But, you know, it's really hard to define anybody with one word.
And your youngest? Is it
actually my middle child is diagnosed with autism? Yes.
And what about your youngest?
He's not diagnosed with anything. He's allegedly neurotypical, but he's pretty unusual himself.
And what about the dynamic between the three of them? How do they, how do they work with each other?
Well, my oldest and my youngest get along extremely well, and they interact together all the time. And it is actually much harder for my middle son, who is the one who is autistic. He has a rather significant language delay, and it is hard for him to fit in with them. But you know, in general, in school also. But so the oldest and the youngest get along magnificently, and it's an ongoing challenge, and it's, you know, it would be nice if, you know, I had some sort of crystal ball or perfect insight as to why it is the way it is. I would love to tell you a story of how beautifully they all get along and support each other, but I don't have a story like that to tell.
Well, I don't think I know of any family with children that, as you said so perfectly earlier, was like a TV show, you know,
no.
You know, like the perfect textbook. I mean, that just really doesn't exist. With children who have no labels, they've got their issues, they've got their peer pressure, and there's nothing new on the face of the earth. It just goes through different phases, but I find that, I mean, generally, I think this is true, children are born without judgment, and then they are taught that over time, either, you know, through any kind of exposure to media or other children or other people.
Mm-hmm.
In your role as the mother of these uniquely magnificent children, how do you deal with just, you know, the everyday? I mean, there is always going to be some kind of sibling rivalry. It's like, oh, that's not fair. How come he or she gets mm-hmm. to do that? And, you know, I did that with my brother. How do you handle that? And what do you do about it that might be different that is working for you?
Well, what I try to do is really respect each child, including the ones that don't have the label, because something I've seen a lot is that people sometimes expect that the non-autistic children will be the ones that will be supporting them or should be nice to them. You know, I mean, that's such seems like such a, you know, blah phrase, but, you know, oh, you have to be nice to your brother, you know, he's autistic or he doesn't understand. And I really try not to do that. In fact, I don't think I do, even though I don't know that I can say never. But so I try to see each child where they are and just let that be okay within the boundaries that I do not allow them, you know, allow them as much as I can allow them to do anything or not do anything, but I call their attention to, you know, I expect everybody to be kind to each other. But I know that I can't make everybody like each other or make everybody want to play with each other, and I do not make them play, you know, with the child they don't want to play with. You know, we look for ways to be to have things that we can all do. But a lot of times the way I manage things especially when they're excluding my middle son, is I'll try to do something with him, you know, something separate or engage him in another way. So I really try to honor every child where they are and all of their needs and not make one child's special needs just because they're called special needs more special than somebody else's.
Well, I mean, I guess when it comes right down to it, every person on the planet has a special need.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
I mean, it could be on so many different levels. So, once again, you know, societal labels and, you know, dogma practices, it really doesn't work, especially with today's kids, regardless
mm-hmm.
of what level that they're functioning on. Can I ask you just the month and day that your children were born?
Yes, January 28th, May 14th, and November 3rd.
Okay, and is the January 28th your oldest?
Correct.
Okay. Well, you probably haven't looked into the general astrology of your children, but January 28th is Aquarius, and Aquarians
mm-hmm.
are called the soloists of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Every Aquarian is different from even other Aquarians. They
right.
have their feet, they have, they're quirky, they have, they're very kind of, you know, the humanitarian, but Aquarians are just, they're the bohemians, really.
Mm-hmm.
because they go their own way. And May 14th is your middle child.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I mean, that's Taurus, probably at mastership degree, and this is about there's a form of grounding that he carries, and probably some like, you know, stability, because Taurus is an earth sign, and they tend to have both feet on the ground. Now, in his case, how does he act when he's outside in nature?
Oh, he loves being in nature. He walks around, and he has this thing he does, which is a stem. He flicks something like, you know, a stick or a toy or something like that. He just takes it between his fingers, and he flicks, and he just loves walking around outside and being in the sand or being in, you know, just in the backyard or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the earth energy is really important for him, and it is a connection that is made. And November 3rd, your Scorpio child,
mm-hmm.
is going to have an intensity, doing things passionately, and with Scorpio children, Scorpio people in general, there's really not a lot of gray area. It's black and white. You know, you either really love something or you couldn't care less about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is also a very deep inquisitiveness. I'm thinking now we have Scorpio and Taurus, and that's a good balance. And then but that Aquarian is just kind of, she's just out there in her own world, and I've got so many Aquarian friends that, because I like people that are different, you know. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
normal can just, you know, scare me to death. Yeah. Although everybody's got a different level of what is normal for them. But, yeah, third dimensional normal is pretty scary for me. So I would really prefer, you know, situations like where people are different and they think differently. So let me ask you, you know, the birth of your children and the journey that you've been on with them has transformed you, the way you look at the world. You're opening up to all kinds of new possibilities. Has a similar transformation happened for your husband?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, he's with me. I'd like to say every step of the way. I mean, he is with me every step of the way, but, of course, having his own personal experience of it. But, yes, yeah. Actually, when I was writing the book, when I gave it the title, Swan Mothers, I was asked, yeah, I was, you know, advised by my writing coach, you know, well, you know, you're going to be cutting out, you know, half the people in the world because, you know, it's, you know, not, you can, why don't you have it parents? But I just felt that it was important to write from my own personal perspective. But yes, he has also been completely changed by the journey.
Well, many fathers find themselves in mothering positions,
mm-hmm.
From the age of 12, my father had to mother both of us, both my brother
mm-hmm.
and myself. And it's really amazing that men, you know, certain men can reach down and find that, because men have the feminine, women have the masculine. We all have both sides of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
You know, to find a husband who can do the mothering as well. I mean, that's just really precious treasure. Because
mm-hmm.
There's probably times when you have to kind of switch roles a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being like ambidextrous like that, you know, it's like, okay, you know, I'll fix the plumbing and you fix dinner.
mm-hmm.
kind of
mm-hmm.
So,
right.
I love the concept of, because the children that are coming to the planet are changing the world, and certainly the first step is helping parents transform, and that is really so critical, because parents who can't change and they want their children to be, like you said, little mini versions of them with some improvements maybe, that just can't really work. There's no future in that. So the parents that are wise enough, open enough, awake enough to let their children teach them, and I know I do a lot of readings where, and people say, absolutely, my children came here to teach me,
mm-hmm.
to start, you know, and then they can move out on their own and you know, spread their wings. But first thing that they do is open their parents up, if their parents are conscious enough to allow that to happen. And I'm so glad that you are.
Well, thank you. I think that's one of the exciting things, is that, of course, we need leaders and seers and visionaries to set the tone for changing the world, but it really takes a lot of people who are open, and so many people have children that just seems like such a great way to be changed. You know, I think if we're willing to change for anybody, most of us are willing to change for our children. Maybe we're not willing to change for our parents or for our boss or something like that. But
right.
for our children, we're willing to do almost anything, including shake up these, you know, long-held beliefs, these things that we absolutely knew to be true, 100%. We were so sure about it. We knew that this was the way the world worked. And for our children, we're willing to say, well, maybe not. And I think that that's one of the exciting things that's happening with our children. And even though I started writing the book from the perspective of autism, by the time I finished, one of the reasons autism didn't end up in the title was because I realized that it's not just autistic children. It's not just my children. It's really just like everybody has special needs. Everybody is uniquely magnificent. Everybody is magnificently unique. I mean, we all are bringing something. And it's just an exciting time when the kids are coming and they're showing their parents that there's going to be a new way to do life.
Absolutely. And, I mean, your children are still very young, and there's no telling what will manifest within them. Certainly, you know, it is only beginning with them. And I mean, a lot of people have awakenings later, you know, sometimes 20, sometimes 30. There's just no telling what they may bring to the table that's just a little seed under the ground right now that you can't see. So
absolutely.
So certainly there may be some great surprises that they will bring you in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think maybe even that's why, even the way I talk about my own life, or, you know, before children, you know, their last life might be like that now too. Maybe they need a calm and quiet place to do whatever they're doing, get used to life here, to acclimate, to grow, to become who they are. So, of course, they're not done, and I suspect neither am I.
Well, you know what? As long as you're alive, I mean, everybody, you continue to grow. And when the growth stops, then you're, you know, getting ready to leave. And so, you know, you just keep growing and expanding and continue the journey. So
mm-hmm.
We have a caller on the switchboard now who has a question about the hero's journey. Let me get your microphone open here. Hello, Eliana. You are on the air with Natalia.
Oh, hi, Ariel. This is Eliana. Natalia, first of all, I just wanted to say that I think that it's so beautiful what you said, and I'm going to paraphrase that even without special, quote-unquote, you know, abilities, that neurotypical and neuroatypical children are alike and that they can change the world just by being or people, you know, primarily their parents. And I know, for going back to what Ariel said just a little bit ago, my daughter came into the world to be my biggest teacher. So you know, I can totally relate to that. But I have questions for you regarding the hero journey. I mean, obviously that was a big part of you writing your book, it seems. But can you tell me a little bit more about it? I wasn't clear what it meant.
Oh, okay. So would you like me to describe the hero's journey? Is that your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would be happy to do that, and I think that I just went through it way too fast. So let me see if I can do it better this time. And so what the hero's journey is, it's an idea that a man named Joseph Campbell came up with, and it's the idea that everybody's story, pretty much everybody, it's like a story arc that happens in everybody's life, and certainly like in heroes and books. So I will tell you the examples that I use in my book from The Ugly Duckling, and I'll just give you a really short description of how it might relate to being a parent. So, and just so you know also that the way I did it, I picked 7 steps. There are actually more steps. Not every story has every step, so that's how it goes. So what the hero's journey is it's like it's like a circle. So you start and you're living in the ordinary world. So if you're familiar with the story of the Ugly Duckling, are you familiar with that story? Okay. So for example, so for the Ugly Duckling, I said, well, for the Ugly Duckling, really the only ordinary world that you know, the duckling knew was in the egg. So it was there, everything was fine, and all of a sudden the egg hatches, and it's out in a different world. Like, it's no longer safe, it's no longer comfortable. And that's part of the hero's journey. It's called the call to adventure. And the way that happens usually for people who have children that are in whatever way unusual, I'm going to talk about autistic children just to make it easier with without having to say 100 words. A lot of times that call to adventure comes when the child is diagnosed with autism. But for some parents, like some of the parents that I interviewed told me that they knew immediately. As soon as they held their newborn, they knew that something was different, like especially people who had had other children. Like they said, I was holding my child. Everybody was telling me it was colic. I knew it wasn't colic. I knew there was something more. Some people have children that are very sick, and suddenly you're not like on this normal parenting road because you knew you were going to be a parent if you were expecting a child, but suddenly something is completely different, and that's called the call to adventure.
I see.
And so the next thing that happens for a lot of people is the refusal of the call. So a lot of people will just say, nope, I don't want to do this. Like, I don't want to be a special needs parent. I don't want to be the parent of an indigo child or an autistic child. And, like, you try to say no, but a lot of times you really can't, right? Like, if you have a child that is having seizures, or if you have a child who is 4 and not talking, or if you have a child that is having terrible tantrums every time you try to dress them or feed them, you know you really can't do normal anymore. And that's where in the hero's journey there is a stage called crossing the first threshold. And that's sort of like when you really step off the path of the life you were living, and now you're going to be walking a different path. Suddenly something is different. You're not doing ordinary life anymore.
I see.
And for a lot of people who have autistic children, that first threshold will start with, you know, you'll be doing research, you'll be learning about maybe what autism means, maybe you'll be learning about what indigo means, whatever it is, that whatever words that were that called you off the path, you'll be finding that out and doing research and just trying to figure things out, maybe talking to other parents, maybe joining groups online, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next part of the journey, for many people this is the longest part, but any one of them can be the longest. It's called the road of trials. And that's sort of on my journey, and what happened for so many mothers that I interviewed is that's when you like kind of put on your boots and you're like, I'm going to beat this thing. So you do therapies, you do treatments, you're trying to figure out how am I going to make this kid normal? Because maybe you still think that that's possible at that point. I know I did. I thought that it was a disease. And so this was the road of trials. And what happens to a lot of people is they can get stuck at any point in this journey. Like some people can get stuck in their refusal call and just say, no, I'm not going to do anything. There's nothing wrong. And there is nothing wrong, but that doesn't mean you can keep living the life you were living. So a lot of people get stuck in like this therapy cycle or this fixing it cycle. But what happened for me and for the mothers that I interviewed was that there came a point where like you just got to like this lowest low. And then the hero's journey, that's called falling into the abyss. And It's sort of like what it sounds like. You just, you know, you're in that place where you're just like can't even see a way out. Like you're just in this deep dark hole and just can't imagine anything. I'll share one rather dramatic story from the book. One of my friends and the woman that I interviewed, she had a son that, in addition to having classic symptoms of autism, he was having seizures, multiple seizures a day. She said she was laying on her bed praying for the roof to fall on her head because, you know, she just couldn't do it anymore. And then she literally kind of saw the light and realized that if I don't accept my son's seizures and all, then I don't accept him because this is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had a rather dramatic transformation. My transformation was less dramatic. For me, it was more of kind of like, you know, I got up the next day and I said, oh, I'm going to homeschool. And then I kind of trudged through that for a couple of years before I, quote unquote, kind of got better at it or got it right or figured out how to do it. But eventually that turnaround comes and it can be dramatic. It can be slow. I mean, for a lot of people, it's just a lot of little things where finally you're like, hey, you know, I'm not in that pit anymore. You know, sometimes somebody comes and helps you, like you meet just the right person or, you know, just find something that really helps. And that can be your turnaround. And that time, that point where you have that turnaround and the hero's journey is called revelation and transformation. And suddenly, like, for people on the journey with children, it's you realize that there's no normal child to recover because there's only a child to see and love. There's nothing to be fixed. There's nothing to be done.
Mm-hmm.
You just have what you have, and you go with it. And suddenly, it's interesting because, like, in a way, nothing has changed. Right? You still have the same child. They haven't had one of the miracle cures or the miracle turnarounds. But suddenly, everything is different. Suddenly, you just see everything differently. And so that's called revelation. And then the end of the hero's journey is actually called the return because, in the end, maybe you've heard the phrase, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. So that's when you come back kind of full circle and say, okay, well, wow, you know, like I saw the light and I'm all great and my kids are all great, but look, there's that pile of laundry and I need to go grocery shopping. But somehow it's all different. Even though, you know, even though in a way nothing has changed, everything is different. And so that is the cycle of the hero's journey.
Oh, thank you so much. So it was just the journey to accept the things as they are and just love your kids exactly the way they are.
Well, yes. Yeah. That was my experience of the journey, yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks
Hi,
for calling,
ladies.
Ileana. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye. Bye.
Well, that was very well said, Natalia. We have another caller, and I'll get the microphone open here. Marianya, welcome.
Hello. Yes, I'm here.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. There. Is that better?
Yes. Okay, great. Wow, there's a lot being talked about in this. And I have a question, and I also have a comment. And my question is that I've heard that the new kids coming in, not necessarily autistic, but that the new kids, the new vibration of child, they are not liking food so much. They need liquid nourishment, smoothies and superfoods because they just don't like the texture of food. Have you heard anything about that or had any experiences with that?
You know, I have. I have not heard exactly what you're saying. I have heard all kinds of things that might sound kind of unusual. I've heard that the kids are going to thrive on junk food. I personally have a hard time wrapping my mind around that, but I have heard that. So as far as them craving liquid things, I have not heard that, but I can tell you that a lot of them are orally sensitive. Two of my children were, and I did have to puree everything for a really long time, but I know in my children's case, once we kind of took care of the oral sensitivities, and for us, the kind of the trick for that was homeopathy. We were able to, they now eat normal food and enjoy it and prefer it that way, but it is possible. I guess, I do not know specifically. I don't know if Ariel has anything to say about that or somebody else knows, but I do not know that they are desiring specifically liquid foods.
How long does that last?
You know, in a way that it is not because of a sensory issue, but because that's really their true desire.
Yeah. Well, and see, putting it as an orally sensitive that way, that may be what the key is. And so I'm curious, how long did that last with your children?
Well, my son, I think I would say that it was worse for them. They both gagged on food, I want to say he was about 4 and a half when he started being able to eat regular food. Okay. And I have a couple of articles on my website if you want to check there about that. Actually, what I did, I can tell you briefly. If I don't know if that's something that you want to hear or if you want to look it up. Or are you interested in hearing that?
It would be okay to look it up unless you want to talk about it. That's fine, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, so I mean, there are things that occupational therapists do with the children. I actually chose not to pursue that route. We did do homeopathy, but what I started doing with my son, which worked, and I don't even know why or if this would magically work, but it did work for us, was I started juicing in the morning and just giving him celery pineapple juice, and somehow with improving his nutrition, that seemed to make a difference. The other thing that I did was while he was having trouble eating was that I would make everything into pancakes. So I would puree the food and mix it with gluten-free pancake mix and fry it, and he ate it. But eventually he just came around. But I think you just have to be really, really patient. And I didn't know as much as I know now. I would have been more patient. I mean, I knew that he was having trouble, but I didn't know how to get around it. But I would just be very patient and go slowly. And, you know, if your child is doing okay with smoothies, I mean, assuming you're putting healthy foods in the smoothies, I think you're doing okay. I mean, I think that moving towards real food and chewing is probably the best way to go as far as I know. I'm not really, you know, I mean, maybe we are evolving away from food. I do not know that. You know, I can't speak to that. But I mean, I think that the best thing in general for kids is to learn how to chew. It's important for other reasons also for them, you know, as far as speaking and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's very helpful. I think, thank you for that. And is it mm-hmm. okay if I wanted to make a comment as well, that's not a question. Is that okay with you?
It's okay with me.
Okay.
Sure, go ahead.
It was about how autism affects the rest of the family, partially, and what I have done, I don't have autism in my family, but I studied rapid eye technology, and Dr. Renee Johnson had an autistic son, which is how she came after years and years of struggling to find a way to help the rest of the family, not so much the autistic child, but the trauma that everyone else went through. And so it's a way to just work with how they feel, not so much telling a story, but how you feel and releasing that and shifting the perspective, which you were talking about, in a way that one day you just kind of go, oh, you see things differently. And so that's a perspective change. But the other thing is I was having a conversation with a lady who's worked with autistic children the other day, and she came to the home of a family that the child was just would not settle down at all. And so what she did, because of her family background and metaphysics, is she just telepathically sent a message to the child that, I'm here to help. You're safe with me, and the child heard it and responded by settling down and working mm-hmm. with her. Have you ever had any experiences like that where you just mind to mind spoke to the child and had any
I personally have not. I personally have not had experiences with that like that, even though I have tried it. I mentioned them a little bit earlier. I'm not sure if you were able to hear, but there are a couple of women who do quite a bit of work with that. And one is Susie Miller, and the other one is Gail Barclay Levy. Have both books out, and they both talk about that in greater detail. Susie Miller, in particular, she works with those kind of ideas. Of communicating with the children telepathically, and she has seminars for parents and things like that.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for calling, Marianya.
Oh,
bye-bye.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was some really, really good feedback there. And if there is anyone else that has a comment or question, just press 1, and you can come on the air. We do have a little bit of time left. So, Natalia, is there anything else that you'd like to kind of wrap up with?
What would I like to wrap up with? I think for me the most exciting thing has been just to discover that it's possible that what I know isn't true, that there might be something new to learn, and that for me it's more important to look at everything now with a sense of wonder and question instead of thinking I have all the answers, which was my default mode before. You know, I always like to read, I always like to research, and I always thought that I could figure everything out, and I've learned that sometimes there's not just one answer, and sometimes the answer isn't what it is. So I think that that's the biggest thing that I've learned, and I think that's the most important thing that I'm continuing to learn, is just that, you know, to ask that question, what else is possible? What else is going on here that I'm not seeing?
Right, right, yeah, and just you're not painting yourself into a corner with preconceived ideas and going with the flow of the energy is the easiest and the most productive way.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what about dreaming, either for you or for your children? Are there ever any stories of dreams that either you or your children have had that might give you clues?
Well, actually, it's funny. I opened my book with a dream. Actually, let me just kind of flip to it so I can remember it exactly. But I can. I actually opened my book with a dream that I suppose is a clue. And the dream I opened my book was that it was actually a recurring dream that I opened the book with. It's actually the very first thing, is that I'm driving on a bridge in the Florida Keys, and my kids are in my minivan with me, and the sky is blue, and everything is beautiful, and the water is sparkly, and all of a sudden, my car is driving on air. And I can see the bridge next to me, but I'm not on it. And always at this point of the dream, I would wake up because I was terrified that, of course, my car is going to plunge into the water. But then as I wake up, I always realize that my car didn't plunge into the water. that was just the fear. I mean, but in the dream, the car never crashes. It never even goes towards the water. I'm just afraid that it'll crash because everybody knows you can't drive on air, right?
Oh, right. I mean, you don't have to be a doctor. I mean, to figure that one out, because obviously you are not on the same road as the rest of the people who are driving and staying between the lines and, you know, firmly based in third dimensional beliefs and you're floating along on a higher plane. And there is no danger of falling into the water because you have escaped that concept of if you don't do things like this, then you'll be lost.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you are definitely on a road that you chose, and certainly your children are helping you pilot the journey in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the funny thing is, since I wrote the book, I haven't had that dream. I used to have that dream pretty frequently. So,
Wow.
Yeah.
And were your children born yet when you first started having the dream?
They were, because I later on, somebody had actually asked me about that dream. They said, well, maybe it was a premonition, you know, like about how things were going to be. But they were already born, so it's pretty interesting. I think maybe, you know, to hear you say it, like you said, it sounds so obvious, but it's so funny. Like, you hear things that are obvious, you maybe didn't think of it yourself exactly that way. But, yeah, they were already born, and, you know, in the dream, they're not small. So it's interesting, I think, that even as I was doing it, maybe it was just the dream was a reassurance that there would be no plunging into the water, you know, even though it looks scary. even though it looks scary, that it's okay and safe.
Yeah, well, you've certainly taken the high road in so many ways, and we're just so happy that you were able to come and share your book and your transformation with our audience.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure to be here.
Once again, I'd just like to say that your websites are swanmothers.com and your personal website, Natalia Arena.
Yes.
Getting that pronunciation down, and that is NATALIAEREHNAH.com.
Mm-hmm.
So please take a look at Natalia's websites and pick up the book, because being better parents, transforming the way we raise our children, is all part of the new world that has just begun. So, Lavendar, do you have anything that you'd like to add before we wrap it up?
Only that we have a lot of new children being born to the planet. We have a lot of walk-ins now walking the earth. We have people that have awakened. We have so many star seeds that are awakened, and maybe they're not out there, you know, beating the drums, but they're silently waiting. And the waiting process is one that has to do with planning everything before they came to the planet, because there is going to be a huge event that takes place, and that's the extraterrestrial piece that's going to happen when hundreds and hundreds of spaceships come down and everyone sees them all at once. Then things change on this planet, and the people that are starseed or awake, that are now awake and just waiting to find out what to do, they'll come alive and they'll know what to do. And these new kids that are on the planet, they too will go into motion, because a lot of this has been planned many, many, many years before, you know, we had the activation that ended in 2012. A lot of people just wanted to come and be here after 2012, and I'm noticing that with a lot of the readings that I do. So there's great hope for us here on the planet, because we have so many, many people that have chosen to be born, to come here, either as walk-ins or to have the third dimensional body. And I'm very excited to know that things are changing. We watch the news and we get bummed out about what we see, and we hear about, you know, earth changes and volcanoes and all kinds of things. But the best kept secret is that there's going to be a day of reckoning with the star seeds and the autistic kids and the indigos and the crystal children. And it's going to be a glorious day when we all can stand up and say, yeah, we came here and we did it. So that's what I'd like to say.
And well said it was.
Okay.
So, Natalia, once again, thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's been our pleasure to visit with you. And for everyone listening, thank you for tuning in. And thank you to Chris and Fiona for hosting the switchboard, and all of our team at Starseed Hotline. We wish you a wonderful, happy Thanksgiving, and remember to count your blessings not only on Thanksgiving Day, but every day, because you count your blessings every day, be assured that more are on the way. I just made that up. Okay, but it's so true. It is so true. So, Natalia, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you so much for having me.
You are so welcome. So with that, everyone, I wish you a great night and happy Thanksgiving. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.